everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson. My guest today is Annette Gordon-Reed, and we're here to talk about her new book, Jefferson on Race. So it's not a book that she wrote. It's a collection. It's a book that she assembled of the writings of Thomas Jefferson on race. Now, if you went to school in the United States in the 21st century, you probably received a different image of Jefferson than the one I did, which is that you probably heard that he wrote beautifully in favor of freedom and liberty, and also that he did not live a life in accord with freedom and liberty because he was a slaveholder. Jefferson's reputation, of course, took a huge hit during the Black Lives Matter protests when there was a general reevaluation of slaveholders in American life. This is why, in addition to people wanting to take down statues of Robert E. Lee and John C. Calhoun, people wanted to take down statues of James Madison and George Washington. Of course, the Black Lives Matter protests didn't happen at the turn of the 20th century. For that, what I'm referring to is the revelation that one of Thomas Jefferson's enslaved women, Sally Hemings, was kept as a wife. They had a number of children who he also enslaved. As you'll see, he treated them better than the average enslaved person on Monticello, but Sally and his children were nevertheless slaves. And although people knew this was happening during Jefferson's lifetime, in fact, there's multiple people in this book, Jefferson on Race, who mention that everyone knows that Jefferson has an enslaved, quote, wife and also enslaved children. Historians in the late 20th century decided that was just gossip. It wasn't true. We now have DNA evidence that proves it, but we didn't need DNA evidence. All you had to do was look at the historical record. And my guest today, Annette Gordon-Reed, was the scholar who looked at the historical record and changed the known facts about Jefferson. So if you learned that Jefferson had children with an enslaved woman at Monticello, you learned that as a direct result of the scholarship done by Annette Gordon-Reed. After the music, you'll hear my conversation with her about this book and how we can think about Jefferson, this great speaker for radicalism, who is best remembered today for taking part in the institution of slavery, the greatest affront to freedom and liberty that humans have created. Hello, thank you so much for joining me. Can you begin just by introducing yourself to the listeners?
Okay, I'm Annette Gordon-Reed. I'm a Carl M. Loeb University professor at Harvard University, and I write about Jefferson and slavery and the early American Republic.
All right, well, we're here today to talk about this volume you edited called Jefferson on Race. So it's about 300 pages or so of Thomas Jefferson's writing on race throughout his entire life. I mean, it's very thorough in the kind of documents you got. Mm-hmm. But before we get into there, I just want to take a second to talk about Jefferson and what he means. So Jefferson is just, he's a very tricky figure for me, and I think he's a tricky figure in general for people on the left. So I like to tell people that when Paul Robeson was testifying in front of the House Un-American Committees Act, House Un-American, whatever, the HUAC, Paul Robeson mentions, you know, three people. He said, you know, if HUAC existed in their time, three people would have been called in front of you. And he mentions Eugene Debs, and he mentions Frederick Douglass, and he mentions Thomas Jefferson. And these are obviously, like, for Paul Robeson, in the 40s and 50s, three icons of liberty and freedom and the left and fighting for justice. Mm-hmm. Jefferson is no longer held up next to Frederick Douglass these days.
No, he's not. He isn't. Not at all. Not at all.
And look, I should say, your work is part of the reason why we have a more complicated image of Jefferson. So I just want to begin by telling people how do you deal with and think through this figure who, I mean, he has statements about liberty and justice that you can see why someone like Paul Robeson found him inspiring. And yet there's this whole other side.
Well, it's when he was living, of course, people saw him as a Jacobin. I mean, he was somebody who supported the French Revolution far longer than, most people or anybody, in the United States celebrated it, and was very much keen on the idea that the people should be sovereign and wanted to, fix it so that there would be universal suffrage. Well, white male suffrage, the kinds of things that, in relative terms, he was considered a radical during his time period. And because of race, I think largely because of the question of race and slavery, that has sort of receded somewhat to the background, and people think much more about him on his attitude about African American people. So it just depends on the context. At various times when people are preoccupied with one thing versus the other, then they have a different view of him. I mean, he was a complicated person. He lived a very, very long time and was involved in so many different things that you can really find conflicting sometimes views about things with this person who, had this very, very expansive life and expansive participation in American life.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that comes out in this book as you track him over the years is, you write, and I think somewhere in here you mentioned that Jefferson clearly, I mean, a few times, he saw himself as an enlightened figure, and he saw himself as an enlightened figure on the matter of race. The thing that's much trickier for me is that there's people, plenty of people, both on the left and the right, both white people and black people, including people that Jefferson enslaved, who state publicly that Jefferson was, one of the good ones on race. So even in his own time, his self-image was, it seems to have been widely supported, and that gives us such a historical gulf. Or do I have the, yeah, go ahead.
No, I think that's right. I mean, that was his reputation. I mean, that's the one thing that has been, people ask me, what has surprised me about this after studying him all these years? And there's nothing, no huge surprise, but what it was reinforced to me in the documents is that he really did see himself. He saw himself as what we would call a liberal. He saw himself as a progressive person, and people around the time saw him that way too. As I said before, people saw him as this dangerous radical. There were people who thought he was going to, lead a slave revolt. I mean, these are people from South Carolina, of course, but the more extreme people saw him as because saw him as being dangerous because the words that he wrote and the policies that he pursued, this notion of opening up the government, they could naturally be extrapolated to mean, everybody. And so that was what was considered to be dangerous about him. But it's hard for us to see that because we read the notes on the state of Virginia and see him, venturing his suspicions about blacks' inferiority and so forth. And that becomes the template. That covers everything in terms of how we view him in politics. Though, he was for progressive taxation. He was not so great on women, but, on women's participation in society. He would not be considered, a feminist by any stretch of the imagination, but because we focus on maybe more cultural things a lot that he doesn't live up to at this moment, we forget about the other aspects of him that made him dangerous to people during his time. Progressive taxation, those kinds of things that his counterparts thought would be the death of the country.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk through these issues, I usually say there's one founding father, which is Thomas Paine, who we would truly recognize as a socialist, as an anarchist, who would have been on the barricades And then besides Paine, who ends up not being part of the, you know, American establishment, the figure, by far the most radical figure of the ones who end up taking power in that generation is Jefferson. I worked a decent amount of my dissertation on both the original plan for Washington, D.C. and Frederick Douglass's desire for a revitalized D.C. And when you there's a document, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Jefferson made a little plan for D.C. that's like, it's like one street and eight buildings. That's how radical he was. He said, we don't need an imperial capital. He was an imperialist in many ways, but he didn't want to make a new Rome in that way. And that's not like Washington.
Well, he was anti-British. I mean, he was someone who started out loving the British Empire. And then it's like anything, when you love it and then you hate it, it's two sides of the same coin. And he thought that anything like that, the trappings of that, there was the danger that monarchy would come back. And, you know, we look at that and historians kind of scoff at the notion, or some historians, not all of them, that he could have been serious when he actually thought that Washington and the Federalists were monocrats, or that these were people who favored, a monarchy. It was not a danger, but it was dangerous. I mean, at the 1790s, anything could have happened. Nobody could have known that this was actually going to, that they would get rid of Great Britain. They come back again, the War of 1812. It's not really over until the 19th century. And of course, the British Empire goes on to, you know, become more powerful than ever. After they get rid of us, they go on to become incredibly powerful in the world. But yeah, he actually thought that that was a danger. And Paine, about Paine, he actually kept faith with Paine. He received him when he was persona non grata in the United States, because people saw him as an atheist and so all of the kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean, he doesn't fit my bill as a radical, as a progressive in ways, but that's how he thought of himself, that there was a new world. He believed in he was much more, I would say, optimistic about the notion of progress, that, and he would say a number of times, and I think I think that this was something that he really believed, that succeeding generations would be smarter than previous ones. He said, we are smarter than the ones before us, and people will discover things that we don't know. Now, I don't know that I'm not necessarily that optimistic about it. I don't know that history doesn't go towards one particular place, but I think he really saw that this was like, history was akin to of science, that people would discover stuff, and not anticipating that there might be a time when people attack science, the time that we're in now, but he would have been just flabbergasted by where we are now. Inoculation, vaccination, all those things that could be applied to politics in the world, that you would discover new things. So that optimism was basically how he lived.
Yeah, well, that's something that comes out really striking in your work, is that in his day-to-day life, he lived a world in which Black people could be highly intelligent and effective and trusted. And shockingly, I mean, you argue, and I think this is right, it was actually, since he had this Enlightenment theory of progress, and he believed there were different kinds of societies, and, you know, we all remember the old, you know, the fish that learns how to walk and becomes, you know, a good human. He seems to have thought, well, the Black people in my day-to-day life are every bit as intelligent as they're able to be given their circumstances and education. But I know that some kinds of grapes are better than other kinds of grapes, and some kind of goats are better than other kind of goats. So it's simply a scientific truth that some kinds of people must be better than other kinds of people.
Well, that's the good and the bad of the Enlightenment. I mean, with categorization helps you do some things, but it also can be problematic, because then you start categorizing everything. You start people in a hierarchy, not just grapes, whatever, but individuals. And that was a part of what he believed. Now, he would always say, I'm looking for that. I'm looking to be disproven here, but you know, he had the normal, he had the racial prejudices of his time. I mean, that was the thing that people forget. I think sometimes people have an idea that that people in the 18th century were better on this question than they actually were. This is what he had been raised in, and he believed in that. White supremacy was the order of the day during his time period, and he didn't stray from that.
Yeah, he didn't stray from that. And again, he practiced something that struck him as very, he saw himself as an enlightened slaveholder. And it's just, it's hard to understand. At least it was hard for me reading, you know, these people who are like, they found Jefferson disgusting, and what they found Jefferson disgusting was how good he was to his enslaved people. And that is a hard thing to hold in your mind when for us, the Jefferson's problem is exactly the opposite.
Yeah. No, I mean, once he comes back from France and he has this idea that he's going to ameliorate slavery, then for us, he's kind of lost. Once you think you can do that well, do anything other than abolish it, you're in a problem. But you look around him, there are people who have a completely different attitude about that and don't see any need to try to construct themselves as a good slaveholder because they don't care. So, you know, all of this is, we're looking at this system that to us is just almost unimaginable, and trying to say some are better than others is a problem because it's all horrible. It's all a horrible thing. How did people live like that? But of course, 100 years from now, people will look back at us and wonder how we live the way we do. I mean, just think about things that we could improve, things that we could work better on, we're not tackling at this particular moment.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a classroom teacher, a high school classroom teacher, and my co-teacher, a woman named Michelle, a student asked a question like this, and Michelle said, "Well, who made the shirt that you are wearing right now, and what was the source of its fabric, and was it slave or sweatshop labor?" And we just all in the room had to sort of be like, "Oh my God!" Mm-hmm. Like, this is not to exonerate Jefferson, but I think your point is right.
That, yeah, I mean. Yeah, and it's I guess for us, we don't know we do know who's making the shirts, but we don't live with them, right? I mean, the tough thing there is, you know, it's, we're able to hide from that, but he couldn't hide from that. So he had to develop and did develop rationalizations for how he could have this gigantic mansion and these little, you know, slave dwellings near that, and people remarked on that and would come to visit the contrast between the way he lived and the way enslaved people lived. But we have those contrasts in some ways today, but they're overseas they're overseas and we don't see it.
Yeah, and the intimacy of slavery, I think, is still shocking to us. And, you know, I guess I'm sure it will be in the introduction, but you are the premier world expert on Thomas Jefferson and the intimacy of slavery. So do you want to explain a bit how, you know, Jefferson's family and slavery were integrated in a way that it is, I think, difficult for us to grasp?
Yeah, it's hard for us to grasp, though. The DNA testing on African American people pretty much tells the story of that, you know, the kinds of connections that were made, the biological connections between enslaver and enslaved people. Jefferson's father-in-law had children, six children, with an enslaved woman, and who were, because they're Jefferson's father-in-law, that means that Jefferson's wife had half siblings who were African American and enslaved. And she brought them to Monticello when she married. Instead of, you know, sometimes people who in those circumstances would sell or have the children of their fathers or brothers sent away, she brings them to Monticello and they form the kind of core of Jefferson's household. His valet is his wife's half-brother, 12-year-old half-brother, Robert Hemings, replaced a man who was Jefferson's age at that time. And later on, Jefferson has children with one of those six children. So there are two generations of family connections between blacks and whites. He had, he had other relatives and friends who were involved in these kinds of connections. And it just makes it is hard for us to imagine, because how do you have members of your family in slavery? You know, and how does that work? And if these people are so different and they're really, you're not, how can you let yourself and your family become entwined with them in that kind of way? And so it's a difficult thing for us to imagine, although in every slave society that's ever existed, that has happened. And you can tell that because of law. Law always tells you how to deal with the children of unions between masters and slaves. And so every system, anytime you have men in control of women, over women's bodies, that's going to take place. And it was the same thing here too. I read some statistics some years ago that, well, some huge percentage of African American people have European ancestry. They did some testing of NBA players, and some over half of them had European Y male chromosomes. And so this was ubiquitous. The thing that about Jefferson is not that this was something unusual. It was something that was very, very common. When you have people, you talk about the intimacy of slavery, the idea of people living in close proximity to one another, women working in the household with men. I mean, the same thing, I guess, in the British upper classes, there were instances of maids and women working in the household who ended up having children with the lord of the manor, or the children of the lord of the manor in that way. It's hard to put men and women together, and that kind of thing, that kind of connection, is that kind of mixing is not going to take place. So that complicated his life, and it was became a scandal for him, and they thought for a time that it might ruin his career, but it actually didn't, because sex scandals don't really destroy people's careers. I mean, people try to use them very gleefully to attack their opponents. But people, you know, he bought Louisiana. He'd doubled the size of the United States. People were thinking about that. You know, if that's part of his life, they didn't really care about. So when it came out in 1803, people thought that this would be the end for him, but it really wasn't.
So I'm wondering, I mean, as we're talking about the intimacy, there's also this other, I mean, this is just the most difficult conversation for me, at least, in that it's clear that his children, his enslaved children, were treated better. They were freed. You know, it's almost the Jefferson's treatment of them is almost the institution of slavery working as its defenders claimed it could or should work, that it's a benevolent system. So how do you, and this is something that I struggle with every time I teach 18th and 19th century American culture, how do you address the gradations and the differences and the difficulties without, I mean, I sometimes feel like I'm going to say something that sounds like John C. Calhoun, like, see, he was very nice to them and slavery was good. And I don't know how to handle it delicately.
Well, they couldn't leave, you know? You know, they couldn't leave. If you think about someone being nice to you in some way, but if you'd said, okay, you know, John Hemings, say, you know, the carpenter, the master carpenter there, he knew how, he could make a living. He could have made a living as a carpenter and was very talented. And if he'd said, you know, okay, that's enough of this, I'm going to go, he would have used the force of law to bring him back. So African-American people, if you believe in liberty and you believe in freedom, African-American people deserve that as well. And they were prevented from having that by the force of law. However benevolent people were, the overlay of violence, a potential violence, is always there. So if you talking to your students about living in a gilded cage. You know, you're being treated well, but you have no autonomy. And if people decide that they need some money, they could take your child and sell them, and you know, or divide them up. You know, he gave his daughter, both of his daughters, and when they got married, enslaved people. Now, most of them would have been what he would have thought of age, but we're talking maybe 10, 12, 11. Imagine you have a child and your child can be taken away from you. So there's no amount of nice to you that would be okay for you to have to live in a circumstance where you could be separated from your spouse, separated from your partner or children or whatever. So, you know, it's better. There were people who were not, who might have, you know, he always said he tried to take into account the families, but that was his prerogative to do that. It's the prerogative not to do it. And so you never want to be in a situation where someone has the power to, you know, to take your kids and take your spouse, take your wife. So you can applaud him for not beating people, or, I mean, although people did get whipped at Monticello, but there were some people who did it more than others. And we don't, you know, we look at those folks and say, that's worse. But the whole thing, as I said before, the whole thing is bad. When you can't leave somewhere and you don't have any autonomy, that's what Americans found intolerable. That's why they revolted against Great Britain, even though they had the highest standard of living in the empire. I mean, they were lightly taxed compared to other people, but it was taxation without representation, and they feared what would happen down the road. So the sort of restrictions on them were just completely intolerable. That's how they left. So compare that to living as a chattel, and it's just a very, very, there's no amount of that that can be justified as the person being good.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more that it's unjustifiable. I have trouble getting students to engage, I guess, with the gradations, which I personally, you know, something that Douglas says is, you know, right before he gives you the litany of suffering, is he says, and I, you know, had it better than pretty much anyone else in the slave system. Pretty much every woman had it worse than me, and everyone who was further south had it worse than me. And so being able to teach these two ideas, what Douglas suffered was the kind of, you know, the kind of degradation, the kind of pain, the kind of misery that he writes so beautifully about, not getting to see his mother, is unimaginable for us, or should be unimaginable. And then he's just offhandedly like, and this is as good as the system is. And having to try and get the students to hold both these ideas in mind, that they can't imagine how bad life was for Frederick Douglass, and this was a good version of slavery. And then once you start saying the good version of slavery, that's when I start being like, okay, well, but I mean, but not, you know.
Yeah, not good, really good, because nobody would want to live in this. If you could ask them, I mean, what would, just think of the kind of restrictions that they chafe at, that they get upset about, that are minor compared to the kinds of things that enslaved people would have faced. But you're right. I mean, it's I for a long time there was a debate at Monticello about redoing slave cabins. Before they used to just have the outlines of the cabins, and then there would be some text there that would explain it and so forth. But they decided to build one. And the people, there were a couple of reasons. Number one, that people were concerned. Number one, they were concerned about erosion on the side of the mountain. By doing that, would it damage the mountain? And the other thing is, the people who built it, like John Hemmings, was a carpenter and a joiner. They would have built themselves nice houses, even though they'd be really small. And people might get a wrong idea about slavery. So the first time I went into one, when they built it, and I came out and I heard some people coming out and I heard someone say, that wasn't so bad. It was literally what people, you know, and there's this tiny little thing where, and there it wasn't bad because it was just John and Priscilla. They had no children. So it's just the two of them in this tiny place. But you want to turn around and say, now imagine 8 people living in that house. And, you know, so that's the, you know, you don't want to do something. You're right. I mean, it's exactly what you're saying here. You're trying to show something, but people are constantly looking for ways to make it better, to fixate on the thing that says, oh, it was not as bad as it could have been. But the truth is, it is bad. I mean, overall, people shouldn't be enslaved. Yeah. There's no way to make that an okay circumstance.
Yes, no, of course. And yet to try and understand it in its complexity opens you up to this thing where you can say, well, this cabin only had 2 people in it and this cabin had 12. And it's like, well, sure, the 2-person cabin. Yeah, it doesn't look that bad.
Yeah.
We're heading towards, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, but they couldn't leave.
Yeah, they couldn't leave. No. And you know, this is Emma Goldman. I mean, Emma Goldman says that marriage is slavery, and she says it for that very simple reason. The women can't leave. A man can leave and a woman can't leave. This is what Goldman fixates on, is the not being able to leave. And then the gilded cage, the gildedness is in some, how gilded the cage is very important. The fact that it's a cage is irrefutable.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're heading towards the end of our time, and I just want to ask you about this document that I hadn't read before. It's an anonymous letter to Jefferson. It's written by, it just says, a slave. And it is it's an amazing document in a
very
lot of
long.
Ways. Yeah, it's long, but I mean, I tore through it. For one thing, it quotes Jefferson, you know, to Jefferson, which is just delightful, but it also has this prophetic tone that, I mean, I just feel like we should be reading this person in our literature classes. So what can you tell me about this document and how it's been read over the years?
Well, it hasn't been read that much over the years. And it's, you know, it's been there. And I don't know any scholarly engagements with it. So it'll be interesting to see how people use it from now on, because I'm hoping that this will give it have some more eyeballs on it so people can interpret it. But it is pretty amazing. You know, it would be wonderful if we could find out who actually, you know, wrote it, where it came from. But the papers of Thomas Jefferson, they don't, you know, they haven't been able to track that down. And it may be at some point, maybe something will come to the fore, but it's really amazing that people, that's another example of how people saw him, that he was somebody that's like a piece like that should be directed to.
Yeah. I think there's a text of it online, like on a Monticello website or something. I'll try and put a link to it, because it is the sort of thing, I mean, I teach, you know, I teach like an American literature survey. And you're always looking for the ability to give students a short, punchy bit of text. By short, I mean, yes, it's kind of long, but it's not a 200-page novel. A punchy bit of text that can really, you know, get them to sit up and think, what's going on here? And I thought that, you know, like, it's why people teach What to the Slave is the 4th of July as opposed to some of Douglass's autobiography, because it can just grab the students. That looked to me like something that would grab the students' attention.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Definitely. But I mean, Douglass has the advantage of being Douglass and a known figure, and it's such a challenge directly to an audience, a white audience. But yeah, these things read together are pretty amazing. And along with Walker, I didn't include David Walker's appeal. He addresses Jefferson, but Jefferson's dead at that point. So,
yeah.
And it's not a, you know, a real correspondence, but that, no, it is an amazing, it's an amazing.
I think, I mean, I'm envisioning now a class day just where you read the Declaration of Independence, you read Jefferson's original bit about slavery in there, and then you read this letter from a slave to Thomas Jefferson, and that might give a very different sense of this founding father.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the last thing I wanted to mention, and you brought it up a bit already, I did want to talk about gender. So my friend Michelle, I mentioned her, she always teaches this letter from Nathaniel Burwell. It says to Jefferson, "Hey, how should I teach my daughters? What sort of education do women need?" And Jefferson's sort of like, "You know, I haven't thought about this. It's not that important. They should know how to dance, and probably women will teach them to cook. I don't care." And it's amazing how little time he seems to have spent thinking about women and gender. Could you put together a book like this from Jefferson, or would it be like 20 on women, or would it be 20 pages long?
Well, the interesting thing about that is he says that, but he spends a lot of times educating his granddaughters. He teaches them Latin and Greek and encourages them to do things. So that letter really doesn't describe how the women at Monticello doesn't describe their lives. They're very hit, learned. His daughters, when they go to France, are put in the most prestigious boarding school in Paris at the time, and it's Catholic, and that's a big deal, at home because it's Catholic, and so he doesn't really live like that. He thinks women should, the women in his family are educated.
Yeah,
And
so we're back.
participates in it. He participates in their education. It could be, with granddaughters, with grandchildren. Well, no, the daughter is educated as well. But the purpose of the education was so that mothers could educate their children. They
Yeah.
had to be educated so that they could then do school for their kids.
Yeah, I mean, this Hofstadter's famous reading of Jefferson, which I think is mostly right, is that he is in many ways the life he lived, and then his words on the page are just often difficult to square, and it just sounds like that's where we're back to with Jefferson on women. Again, the man and the let man of letters are hard to hold together in our head.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But it's, I guess, if anybody looked at our lives and followed them from youth to 83, if we're lucky, there would be a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah, not many of us are going to get scrutinized the way Jefferson has.
And he thought about so many different things, and he had voiced opinions on so many different things. Adams doesn't muse about race. Hamilton doesn't muse about race in the same way. Maybe a couple of quotes, but Jefferson, that's the thing about keep creating a paper trail, too,
Yeah.
is that people get to see you doing all kinds of things that, there's, wait a minute, how does this fit with that and the other thing? And not to say that he wasn't, as you said, a tricky person, but I think he just had a lot of. He had a lot of thoughts about things, lots of opinions, and he was moved to put them down, and that makes him a target.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's right, and we're still fighting things. We need to find out who wrote the letter from a slave. Annette Gordon Reed, anything else you would like to add before we go?
No, I just hope that this will be useful to people. That was the idea, to sort of gather things together in one spot. And, also to have the recollections of enslaved people, all of the enslaved people for whom we have recollections at the back of the book, so you can get a sense of how they felt about him and what they thought about him.
I found this eye-opening. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me.